and enter into the autonomic nervous system, and then keep planting the seeds for a new life. And without knowing how it happened, it just happened. And when it did, she felt better than she'd ever felt before. Candace's life is now completely different from her life when she was diagnosed with Hashimoto's. She's a business partner in a personal development program that teaches self-development work, and she also maintains a corporate job. She has a loving relationship, new friendships, and new business opportunities. A new personality ultimately creates a new personal reality. A state of being is a magnetic force that draws events equal to that state of being. So when Candace fell in love with herself, she drew a loving relationship to herself. Because she felt worthy and felt respect for herself and all of life, conditions began to show up for her in which she had opportunities to contribute, to be respected, and to make a difference in the world. And of course, when she moved into a new personality, the old personality became like another lifetime. That new physiology began to drive her to greater levels of joy and inspiration. And the disease then belonged to the old personality. She was someone else. It's not that she became addicted to joy. She was just no longer addicted to being unhappy. When she started experiencing greater levels of happiness, she found that there's always more bliss, more joy, and more love to experience, because every experience creates a different blend of emotions. She started really wanting the challenges in her life so that she could find out to what extent she could take this information into transformation. The ultimate lesson that Candace learned was that her disease and her challenges were never about someone else. They were always about her. In her old state of being, she'd had the firm belief that she was a victim of her relationship and of her external circumstances, and that life was always happening to her. Becoming aware of this work and taking full responsibility for herself and her life, and realizing that what had happened never had anything to do with what was outside of her, was not only a huge empowerment, but also one of the greatest gifts Candace could have ever asked for. Joanne's story. Joanne lived most of her life in the fast lane. The 59-year-old mother of five was also a committed wife, a successful businesswoman, and an entrepreneur who constantly juggled her home life, family dynamics, growing career, and thriving business. Although her goal was to stay sane, healthy, and balanced, she couldn't imagine her life in any other way than intense, fast-paced, and busy. She was living on the edge and proving to everyone that her mind was active and sharp. Joanne constantly pushed herself to take on as much as possible, all the while maintaining exceptionally high standards. She was a leader, admired by many, and regularly sought out for advice. Her peers called her Superwoman, and she was, or so she thought. All of that ended abruptly in January 2008, when Joanne stepped off the elevator in her apartment building and then just collapsed, about 50 feet from her front door. She hadn't felt well that day, so she'd gone to a walk-in clinic for help and been on her way back home. In a matter of moments, everything in her world had changed, and she found herself clinging to life. After 8 months of testing, the doctors diagnosed her with secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, SPMS, an advanced stage of multiple sclerosis, MS, a chronic disease in which the immune system attacks the central nervous system. Symptoms vary widely depending on the individual, but can start with conditions such as numbness in a leg or an arm, progressing as far as paralysis and even blindness. These symptoms can include not only physical, but also cognitive and psychiatric problems. Joanne's symptoms had been so vague and sporadic over the previous 14 years that she had easily brushed them off as byproducts of a hectic lifestyle, But now her condition had a label, and it felt like a life sentence, with no chance of parole. She found herself thrown into the depths of the Western medical world, challenged by its strong belief that MS is a permanent disease. A few years before the diagnosis, Joanne had put the family business in Calgary on hold and made a life-changing move to Vancouver on the west coast of Canada, something her family had wanted to do for years. After the move, Joanne struggled with one challenge after another as the family's eroding finances and resources put them in a very precarious situation. Joanne's self-esteem, confidence, and health all took a nosedive. Once she found herself unable to become greater than her environment, her mental and physical state began to decline. Money became tighter and tighter as other stresses began to increase. Soon, the family couldn't even meet their basic needs of food and shelter. In early 2007, the woman everyone else had always seen as Superwoman hit bottom. And before the end of the year, the family returned to Calgary. MS is an inflammatory disease in which the insulating coverings of nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord are damaged, along with the nerve fibers themselves. The condition disrupts one's nervous system from communicating and sending signals to various parts of the body. The type of MS Joanne developed is a progressive type that builds up over time, often causing permanent neurological problems, especially as the disease advances. Her doctors told her it was incurable. Initially, Joanne was determined that her MS wouldn't define her. Yet she quickly spiraled downward into physical disability and cognitive decline. Joanne had to depend on others for basic care as her limitations increased. Because of her sensory and motor problems, she began to rely on crutches, walkers, and a wheelchair. Eventually, she had to rely on a mobility scooter to get around. It wasn't much of a surprise that she crashed when her life did. Joanne's body finally did her the favor she wouldn't do for herself, that is, to stop and say, no more. She'd pushed herself too hard. Even though she'd achieved success in her early years, deep down inside, she felt like a failure most of the time, because she constantly judged herself and thought that she could always do a better job. She was never satisfied. Whatever she did or achieved was never good enough. Most important, Joanne didn't want to stop doing, because then she would have to attend to that impending feeling of failure. So instead, she stayed busy by putting all of her attention on her outer world. Various experiences with people and things at different times and places, so that she wouldn't have to put any attention on her inner world of thoughts and feelings. The majority of Joanne's life had been filled with supporting others, by celebrating their successes and encouraging them. Yet, she had never allowed anyone to see what wasn't working in her own life. She hid her pain from everyone. Joanne constantly gave, but never received, because she never allowed herself to receive. So, she'd spent a lifetime denying herself her own personal evolution by never expressing herself. It makes sense that when Joanne tried to change her inner world by using the conditions in her outer world, she would inevitably manifest only failure. When she finally collapsed, Joanne was so weak and defeated that she barely had the strength to fight for her life. All that time spent living in emergency mode, constantly reacting to the conditions in her external world, had robbed Joanne of her life force, draining all the energy from her internal world, the place for repair and healing. She was simply tapped out. The one thing that Joanne knew without a doubt was that the damage that the MRI showed was riddling her brain and spinal column hadn't appeared overnight. Her body had slowly been eaten away at her core, the central nervous system. After all those years of ignoring symptoms, she'd become unnerved because she was afraid to look inside herself. Those daily toxic chemicals were repeatedly knocking on the door of her cells, and finally the gene for the disease answered the door and switched on. Bedridden, Joanne made her first goal to slow down the progression of the MS in her body. She knew from reading my first book that the brain doesn't know the difference between what she could make real internally by thought alone and the real external experience, and she knew that mental practice could change her brain and her body. She started mentally rehearsing doing yoga, and after just a few weeks of daily practice, she was able to do some actual physical poses, even some standing ones. These results highly motivated her. Every day, Joanne primed her brain and body by thought alone. Just like the piano players in Chapter 5, who mentally rehearsed playing the piano and grew the same neurological circuits as the subjects who physically practiced the exercises, Joanne was installing the circuits in her brain to look as if she were already physically walking and moving. Remember the subjects in the various weightlifting studies who increased their strength just by mentally practicing lifting weights or flexing their biceps. Just like them, Joanne knew she could make her body look as if the experience of healing had already started to happen, by literally changing her mind. Soon she was able to stand briefly, and then she could walk with support. Joanne was quite wobbly and otherwise still dependent on a mobility scooter, but at least she was no longer confined to bed and feeling sorry for herself. She had turned a corner. When Joanne began to meditate regularly to simply quiet her mind chatter, she became aware of how sad and angry she really was. The floodgates opened. Joanne realized she felt weak, isolated, rejected, and unworthy most of the time. Out of balance, ungrounded, and disconnected, she felt as though she had lost a vital part of herself. She observed how she denied herself by pleasing others, and how she couldn't acknowledge herself without feeling guilty. She recognized that she was always trying to control what seemed to be a spiraling chaos around her, yet it never worked. On a deeper level, she had known this all along, but had chosen to ignore it, pushing herself relentlessly and pretending that everything was okay. Painful as it was, Joanne was now looking at how she'd created her disease. She decided to become conscious of all those subconscious thoughts, actions, and emotions that were defining her as the same personality who'd created this particular personal reality. She knew that once she could look at who she was being, it meant that she'd be able to change those aspects of herself. The more she became conscious of her unconscious self and aware of her state of being, the more she gained dominion over what she'd hidden from view. By early 2010, Joanne felt that the progression of the MS had indeed slowed. Her goal then became to stop it altogether. In May, when she mentioned this idea to a neurologist who asked her what her goals were with the disease, the doctor abruptly terminated her appointment. Instead of becoming discouraged, Joanne was more intent after this incident. When Joanne attended a workshop in Vancouver, she couldn't walk on her own. During the weekend, I asked the participants to set a firm intention in their minds and combine it with an elevated emotion in their bodies. The goal was to recondition the body to a new mind, instead of continuing to condition it with survival emotions. I wanted participants to open their hearts and teach their bodies emotionally what their future would feel like. This was the missing ingredient to Joanne's daily mental practice, embracing thoughts of walking across a 20 to 25 foot floor with only her cane for support excited her beyond belief. She was now adding the second element of the placebo effect to the equation, expectation with emotion. It was this combination, convincing her body emotionally that the future event of healing was happening to her in the present moment, that would take Joanne to the next level. Her body, as the unconscious mind, had to believe it for it to be so. if she were to embrace the joy of being well and give thanks before the healing occurred, then her body would be getting a sampling of her future in the present moment. I suggested to Joanne that she really pay attention to her thoughts, because it was her thoughts that had truly made her sick. I pressed her to get beyond the personality that was connected to her condition, which was necessary before she could create a new personality and a new personal reality. Now she could apply meaning and intention to what she was doing. 2 months after that workshop, Joanne attended a second, more advanced workshop in Seattle. Her scooter had broken down the day before she left for that event, so she used her motorized wheelchair to get around. Despite initially feeling more vulnerable because of that, at the workshop, Joanne soon felt better able to move. Her associative memory related to the positive experience of the last event, and the expectation of getting better in the current event was what initiated that process. If 29% of chemo patients can experience anticipatory nausea before their chemo treatments, as you read in Chapter 1, then maybe it's possible for some of the workshop participants to experience anticipatory wellness when they're back in the workshop setting. Whatever the trigger, Joanne saw a new possibility and with enthusiasm began once again to emotionally embrace that future in the present moment. During the last meditation of that workshop, the magic happened for her. Joanne experienced a huge internal shift, and she felt something that moved her profoundly. She felt her body changing automatically once she entered her autonomic nervous system and it received the new instructions and took over. She felt lifted, overjoyed, and free. After the meditation, Joanne got up from her chair, a different person than she'd been when she sat down. She was in a new state of being. She then walked to the front of the room, without any support, not even her cane. She strutted across the room, wide-eyed, laughing like a child. She could feel and move her legs, which had been dormant for years. She'd gotten out of the way, and it felt incredible. To my amazement, Joanne had signaled new genes in new ways right during that one meditation. She had actually changed her condition in just 1 hour. When she got beyond her MS identity, she became a different person, and that's when she stopped trying to slow, stop, or reverse her MS. She no longer tried to prove anything to herself, her family, her doctors, or anyone else. She understood and experienced for the first time that her true journey was always about wholeness, which is what verifiable healing is always about. She forgot that she had an official disease, and she disassociated from that identity for a moment. The freedom that doing so engendered and the amplitude of that elevated emotion was strong enough to switch on a new gene. Joanne knew that MS was simply a label, like mother, wife, or boss. She had changed that label by simply giving up her past. When Joanne arrived back home 3 days later, unbeknownst to her, the miraculous continued to unfold. While doing yoga, a practice she had begun physically, not just mentally, after attending the second workshop, she noticed that she could lift one foot off the ground. She tried to lift the other. Success! She then noticed that she could flex her feet for the first time in years, and she could wiggle her toes, which she hadn't done in a long time. She was stunned and in absolute awe as tears of joy flowed from her eyes. She knew in that instant that anything was possible, not because of some external medication or procedure, but because of the internal changes she'd made. Joanne knew she could be her own placebo. Within a very short time, Joanne taught herself how to walk again. 2 years later, she is still walking unassisted and is more playful and full of life. Her body strength has improved, and she's now able to do many things that she thought she'd never again be able to do. Most important, she feels alive and filled with boundless joy. Joanne feels whole, and because she can now receive, she continues to receive healing. Joanne recently told me, "My life is magical, full of incredible synergies, abundance, and unexpected gifts of every sort. It bubbles, sparkles, and tingles with a new and lighter reflection of myself. It's the new me. Actually, the real me that I tried to keep under control and hidden for most of my life." Joanne now lives most of her day in gratitude. She still takes the time to be aware of her thoughts and feelings. That is, she cultivates her state of being every day, paying attention to what she tells herself and what she thinks about others, too. In her meditations, she observes herself and becomes familiar with how she acts. Very rarely does a thought get past her conscious mind that she doesn't want to experience. Joanne's current neurologist supports her choices and has been astounded by what she has seen. Her physician has had to acknowledge the power of the mind, which Joanne demonstrated right before her eyes with medical reports and blood tests that show no signs of MS. Lori, Candace, and Joanne accomplished their dramatic remissions using no resources outside of themselves. They changed their health from the inside out, without the use of medication, surgery, therapy, or anything other than their own minds. They became their own placebos. Now, let's take a scientific look into the brains of some other people from my workshops, who were able to make similar, dramatic changes, so that we can see exactly what was going on in the process of these remarkable transformations. Chapter 10. Information to Transformation. Proof that you are the placebo. This book is about making your mind matter. You now understand that the placebo works because a person accepts and believes in a known remedy. A fake pill, injection, or procedure substituted for a real counterpart, and then surrenders to the outcome without overanalyzing how it's going to happen. We could say that a person associates her future experience of a particular known person, say a doctor, or thing, a medication or procedure, at a specific time and place in her external environment, with a change in her internal environment. And in doing so, she alters her state of being. After a few consistent experiences, the person will expect her future to be exactly like her past. Once that link is in place, the process becomes highly effective. It's about a known stimulus, automatically producing a known response. The bottom line is this. In the classic placebo effect, our belief lies in something outside of us. We give our power away to the material world, where our senses define reality. But can the placebo work by creating from the immaterial world of thought and making that unknown possibility a new reality? That would be a more prudent use of the quantum model. The three workshop participants you read about in the last chapter accomplished this feat. They all chose to believe in themselves more than they believed in anything else. They changed from the inside and moved into the same state of being as someone who'd taken a placebo, without any material thing causing the phenomenon. That's what many students continue to do to get better. Once they know how the placebo really works, the pill, injection, or procedure can be taken away, and the same outcome unfolds. Because of the research in these workshops, as well as the constant testimonials I've received from people around the world, I now know that you are the placebo. My students demonstrate that instead of investing their belief in the known, they can place their belief in the unknown and make the unknown known. Think about this for a moment. The idea of verifiable healing exists as an unknown potential reality in the quantum field, until it is observed and realized and has materialized. It lives as a possibility in an infinite field of information, defined as nothing physically, but all material possibilities combined. So the potential future of experiencing a spontaneous remission from a disease exists as an unknown, located beyond space and time, until it's personally experienced and made known in this space and time. Once the unknown beyond the senses becomes a known experience with your senses, you're on the path of evolution. So if you can experience a healing over and over again in the inner world of thoughts and feelings, then in time, that healing should finally manifest as an outer experience. And if you make a thought as real as the experience in the external environment, shouldn't there be evidence in your body and brain sooner or later? In other words, if you mentally rehearse that unknown future with a clear intention and an elevated emotion, and do it repeatedly, then based on what you've learned, you should have real neuroplastic changes in your brain and epigenetic changes in your body. And if you keep moving into a new state of being each day by reminding your brain and conditioning your body to that same mind, then you should see the same structural and functional changes within you as if you took the placebo. Figure 10.1 gives a simple graphic showing how this process unfolds. So instead of aligning your faith, which I define as believing in a thought more than anything else, and your belief in something known, can you place your attention on an unknown possibility and then, by the principles discussed in this book, make that unknown reality known? By emotionally embracing the experience in your mind enough times, can you move from the immaterial to the material, from thought to reality? By now, you should understand that you don't need any fake pills, holy shrines, ancient symbols, witch doctors, whether of modern day or traditional variety, sham surgery, or sacred ground in order to heal you. This chapter introduces the scientific evidence showing how our students did just that. They changed their biology by thought alone. It wasn't just in their minds. It was in their brains. All of the supporting evidence in this chapter is provided to inspire you to see firsthand the power of meditation. It's my desire that once you see proof of what's possible, you'll apply the same principles to your own personal transformation and reap the benefits in all areas of your life. After you read these stories, by the time you get to part 2 of the book, you'll have more intention behind your inward journey, because you'll assign more meaning to what you're doing, and therefore, you'll get better results. I've learned something very important in teaching this work. I've come to the realization that everyone secretly believes in his or her greatness. When you get right down to it, on some level, everyone, whether you're a corporate CEO, a janitor at an elementary school, a single mother of three, or a prison inmate, innately believes in him or herself. We all believe in possibility. We all imagine a better future for ourselves than the reality where we currently reside. So I thought that if I could offer sincere individuals vital scientific information, and then provide them with the necessary instruction on how to apply that information, they could experience varying degrees of personal transformation. Science is, after all, the contemporary language of mysticism. It transcends religion, culture, and tradition. It demystifies the mystical and unifies a community. I've seen it occur time and time again in my seminars around the world. In my advanced workshops, where my colleagues and I measure biological as well as energetic changes in participants, individually and in the group as a whole, I use several principles outlined in this book, and many additional ones as well, to teach people the scientific model of transformation. The model continues to progress as students evolve their skill sets. I constantly tie in more quantum physics to help people understand possibility. I then combine it with the latest information in neuroscience, neuroendocrinology, epigenetics, cellular biology, brainwave science, energy psychology, and psychoneuroimmunology. We see new possibilities manifest as a result of learning new information. Once our students learn and embrace this information, they can assign more meaning to their meditations and contemplative practices. But it's not enough for the students to merely understand the information intellectually or conceptually. They must be able to repeat what they've learned on command. Once they can explain the advancing knowledge, the progressing model will become more wired in their brains, and they can then install the neurological hardware. By then repeating what they've learned enough times, they create a hardwired software program. If they apply this new knowledge correctly, it can then serve as the forerunner to a new experience. That is, once they align their minds and bodies, they'll gain wisdom from a novel experience by embracing the associated new emotion. Now they'll start to embody the information, because they are chemically instructing their bodies to emotionally understand what their minds intellectually understand. At this point, they'll begin to believe and know that it's the truth. But my desire is that instead of just doing it once, my students repeat the experience over and over again at will, until it becomes a new skill, habit, or state of being. Once we achieve consistency, we're on the precipice of a new scientific paradigm, because anything that's repeatable is science. When you and I arrive at the level of competence where we can change our internal states by thought alone, and this is repeatedly observed, measured, and documented, we're on the verge of a new scientific law. Now, we can contribute new knowledge about the nature of reality to the overall scientific model that the world presently embraces, so that we can empower more people. This has been my ambition for years. I've gone to great lengths to teach our workshop participants the specifics of how inward practices biologically change the brain and body, so they understand explicitly what they are doing. When nothing is left to conjecture, dogma, or supposition, we're more suggestible to a quantum possibility. And great strides result from great efforts. Nevertheless, the measurements are only as good as the students' abilities. So in my workshops, the students retreat from their lives for 3 to 5 days to help them no longer define themselves by their present past personal reality. They practice moving into new states of being. By no longer reaffirming aspects of their old personality self that don't belong to their future, and by pretending to be someone else, or by reinventing a new personality self, they become the new self they envision. So they should produce epigenetic changes, just as did the older men in Chapter 4, who pretended they were 22 years younger. It's my desire that workshop participants get beyond themselves and their identities, in their meditations to become no body, no one, no thing, and to be in no place and in no time, so that they become pure consciousness. Once this occurs, I've seen them change their brains and bodies ahead of their environments, their familiar lives, so that when they return to their lives after the workshop is over, they're no longer the victims of unconscious conditioning from the external world. This is the domain where the uncommon and the miraculous happen. Because I want to give students the right kind of instruction and provide them with opportunities to personalize all of the novel information they're learning so that they can ultimately produce some type of personal transformation, I created a new kind of event in 2013. If you remember, I discussed the evolution of this idea in the preface. In the new workshop offering, held first in February of that year in Carefree, Arizona, and again in July in Englewood, Colorado, I wanted to measure the transformation as it was happening in real time. My intention was that once these measurements were obtained, the data would then become more information that I could use to teach participants about the transformation they'd just experienced. And with that information, they could have another transformation, which could be measured, and on it would go as people began to close the gap between the two worlds of knowledge and experience. I call these workshops Information to Transformation. It's where my passion lies. When I began the journey, I discovered a brilliant and talented neuroscientist named Jeffrey Fannin, PhD, who selflessly helped me measure what students' brains were doing. Dr. Fannin, the founder and executive director of the Center for Cognitive Enhancement in Glendale, Arizona, has worked in the field of neuroscience for more than 15 years and has extensive experience in training the brain for optimal performance. He specializes in head trauma, stroke, chronic pain, attention deficit disorder, ADD, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, anxiety disorders, depression, and trauma recovery, as well as high-performance training that includes brain mapping for sports, enhancing leadership skills through brainwave entrainment, improving brain function, enhancing mental and emotional dexterity, and personal transformation. Over the years, he has been involved in cutting-edge research using electroencephalography, EEG technology, which measures the electrical activity of neurons to accurately assess how balanced a person's brainwave energy is, a measurement he calls the person's whole brain state. His research focuses on subconscious belief patterns and merging personal success with balanced brain performance. Dr. Fannin has also worked as part of a research team at Arizona State University, studying neuroscience and leadership using data gathered at the United States Military Academy at West Point. This research allowed him to co-develop and co-teach a unique course at Arizona State University called The Neuroscience of Leadership. He also served for several years on the faculty at Walden University near Phoenix, teaching cognitive neuroscience at the master's and doctoral levels. I invited Dr. Fannin and his whole team to both of these new workshop events, where we measured specific brain qualities and elements like coherence versus incoherence, the orderliness or disorderliness of brainwaves, which you'll read more about in the next chapter, amplitude, the energy of the brainwaves, phase organization, the degree to which the different parts of the brain are working together in harmony, the relative time it takes for a person to enter deep meditation, how long it takes to change brainwaves and move into a more suggestible state, the theta-alpha ratio, the degree to which the brain functions in a holistic state, and how different brain compartments communicate with each other across entire regions, the front with the back, and the left side with the right side, the delta-theta ratio, the ability to regulate and control mind chatter and intrusive thoughts, and sustainability, the brain's ability to consistently maintain a state of meditation over time. We also created 4 brain scan stations, equipped with EEG machines, to measure participants both before and after the workshop, so that we could observe how students' brainwave patterns changed. We scanned more than 100 participants in each of the 2 events. I also randomly selected 4 participants to measure during each of the 3 meditation sessions per day, scanning their brains in real time. Altogether, in both 2013 workshops, we recorded a total of 402 EEGs. This is a safe, non-invasive procedure that takes measurements from 20 locations on the outside of the head. Those brain wave measurements provide a host of information regarding the brain's current ability to perform. The EEGs were then converted into quantitative EEGs, qEEGs, which is a mathematical and statistical analysis of EEG activity that's depicted as a brain map graphic. This graphic features color gradations, indicating how the activity recorded from the EEG compares to normal baseline activity. The various colors and patterns depicted at different frequencies offer greater information about how the brainwave patterns affect a person's thoughts, feelings, emotions, and behaviors. For starters, our overall data demonstrated that 91% of the individuals whose EEGs we recorded presented a significantly improved state of brain function. The majority of our students moved from a less coherent or less orderly state to a more coherent state by the end of the transformational meditation sessions. Furthermore, more than 82% of the qEEG brain maps we recorded in both events demonstrated that participants were functioning within the healthy, normal range of brain activity. I learned that when your brain works right, you work right. When your brain is more coherent, you're more coherent. When your brain is more whole and balanced, you're more whole and balanced. When you can regulate your negative and intrusive thoughts every day, you're less negative and intrusive. And that's exactly what we witnessed with the students at these events. The national average for someone to move into and sustain a meditative state is a little over 1.5 minutes. That is, it takes that long for most people to change their brain waves and move into a meditative state. The average time for our students to enter and sustain a meditative state in the 402 cases that we measured, was only 59 seconds. That's under a minute. Some of our students were able to alter their brain waves and their state of being in as few as 4, 5, and 9 seconds each. To be clear, I'm not interested in making this a competition, which would defeat our purpose. However, this data does illustrate two important points. First, moving beyond the analytical mind of beta brainwaves and entering into a more suggestible state is a skill that you can improve if you keep practicing it. Second, students are able to use the methods my colleagues and I are teaching to get beyond their thinking brains and enter into the operating system of the subconscious mind relatively easily. Interestingly, our research also shows a noticeable, consistent patterning in the way our students' brains work holistically. We see significant, alternating alpha-theta patterns, how different brain compartments communicate with each other, in the frontal lobes when a person meditates. That means the two halves of the brain are talking in a more balanced and unified fashion. The dual frontal lobe ratio patterns we repeatedly observe seem to produce the experience of high-level thankfulness and gratitude, which appear over and over again, in a rhythmic, wave-like manner. So when students are in this heightened state of gratitude during mental rehearsal, this data suggests that their inner experience is so real that they believe that the events are happening to them in real time, or that the events have already happened. They're thankful because that's the emotion we feel when what we want happens. Experienced meditators also showed an increase in theta and low-range alpha brainwave ratios, which means that they can spend quite a bit of time in altered states. Of particular significance was the increase in slow wave regulation. These students, while in the theta brainwave state, have higher than normal coherence or brainwave orderliness between the activity in the front of the brain and the regions in the back of the brain. We saw the left frontal region, which is associated with positive emotion, get activated repeatedly, which is consistent with inducing a state of meditative bliss. In other words, when these students enter a meditation, they produce slower, more coherent brain waves that suggest they're in deep states of relaxation and heightened awareness. In addition, the unification between the front and the back of the brain, as well as between the left and right sides of the brain, indicates that they're feeling happier and more whole. Finally, while I was observing a student who was being brain mapped in real time during a meditation at the first of the two events, I understood something quite remarkable. As I was watching her brain on the scan, I saw how hard she was working and how her brain was moving further and further away from balance and from the deeper meditative states of alpha and theta. I saw how she was analyzing and judging herself and her life within the emotion she was experiencing at that time, as evidenced by the higher, more incoherent brainwaves associated with a high-range beta state, indicating high stress, high anxiety, high arousal, high emergency, and general imbalance. I witnessed how she was futilely trying to use her brain to change her brain, and it wasn't working. I knew that she was also using her ego to try to change her ego, which also wasn't working. In using one program to try to change another program, she was only endorsing her program, not rewriting it. She was still in her conscious mind, trying to change her subconscious mind. So she was keeping herself separate from the operating system, where true change resides. I approached her afterward, and when we spoke for a few minutes, she admitted to me that she was having a difficult time. The lights went on for me in that moment, and I knew exactly what I had to teach next. She had to become detached and move beyond her body in order to change her body, move beyond the ego in order to change the ego, move beyond the program in order to change the program, and move beyond the conscious mind in order to change the subconscious mind. She had to become the unknown in order to create the unknown. She had to become an immaterial new thought in nothing materially, in order to create a new experience materially. She had to move beyond space and time in order to change space and time. The student had to become pure consciousness. She had to get beyond her associations with an identity that was associated with her known environment. Her home, her job, her spouse, her kids, her problems. Beyond her body, her face, her gender, her age, her weight, and her looks. And beyond time, the predictable habit of living in the past or the future, always missing the present moment. She had to get beyond her current self to create a new self. She had to get out of her own way so that something greater could take over. When we are matter trying to change matter, it never works. When we are the particle trying to change the particle, nothing will happen, because we're vibrating at the same speed as matter, and so can't have any significant effect on it. It's our consciousness, our intentional thought, and our energy, our elevated emotion, that influences matter. Only when we are conscious can we alter our brains, our bodies, and our lives, and create a new future in time. And because it's consciousness that gives form to all things, and that uses the brain and body to produce different levels of mind, once you arrive in the place where you are pure consciousness, you're free. So I began to let students linger for extended periods of time in their meditations and become no one, no body, no thing, and be in no place and in no time until they were comfortable in the infinite field of possibilities. I wanted students' subjective consciousness to merge with the objective consciousness of the field for long periods of time. They had to find the sweet spot of the present moment and invest their energy and awareness in a void that is not really empty space, but is actually filled with an infinite number of possibilities, until they were comfortable in the unknown. Only once they were truly present in this potent place beyond space and time, the place from where all things materially come, could they start to create. This was when the real changes during the workshops began to happen. I want to introduce you to two types of brain scan readings so that you can see and understand the changes I'm about to show you. Let's make it simple. The first type of scan we used measures degrees of activity between brain areas. See figure 10.2, located along with the rest of the figures for this chapter, in the full-color insert pages. The scans map two relative types of this activity. Hyperactivity, or overregulation, is depicted by red lines connecting different locations in the brain. Imagine telephone lines connecting one place to another in order to establish communication between those areas. Having too many red lines at any one time indicates too much action taking place within the brain. Hypoactivity, lack of regulation, is depicted by blue lines, indicating that minimal information is being communicated between the different brain areas. The thickness of the lines represent the standard deviation, or how much dysregulation, or abnormal regulation, exists between the two locations the line connects. For example, the thin red lines indicate that the level of activity between those locations is 1.96 standard deviations, SD, above normal. The thin blue lines indicate that the level of activity between those locations is 1.96 SD below normal. The medium lines indicate 2.58 SD, either above red or below blue normal. And the thick lines indicate 3.09 SD, above or below normal. So when you see a lot of thick red lines in a scan, it means the brain is working too hard. When you see a lot of thick blue lines, it suggests there's little communication between different areas of the brain, and therefore the brain is underactive. Think of it like this. The thicker the red line, the higher the volume of data the brain is processing. And the thicker the blue line, the lower the volume of data the brain is processing. The second type of scan we used comes from the QEEG analysis and is called a Z-score report. Z-score is a statistical measure that tells us not only whether a point is above or below average, but also how far from normal the measurement is. The scale on this report ranges from -3 to +3 SD. The darker blue represents 3 or more SD below normal, while the lighter blues range from about 2.5 to 1 SD below normal. Blue-green is approximately 0 to 1 SD below normal, while green is baseline normal. Light green registers at the outer area of normal, but is considered from 0 to 1 SD above normal, while yellow and light orange are approximately 1 to 2 SD above normal. Darker orange is about 2 to 2.5 SD above normal, and red is 3 or more SD above normal. See figure 10.3. The Z-score report that will be used is called relative power, and it shows information about the amount of energy in the brain at different frequencies. Because green, as explained previously, indicates the normal range, the more green there is in a scan, the more the person is conforming to normal brainwave activity. Each colored circle, resembling a person's head when viewed from the top, represents what one person's brain is doing at each brainwave frequency. The circle in the upper left region of each scan shows the lowest brainwave frequency in delta brainwaves, and each circle after that depicts a higher and higher brainwave state, moving progressively up to the highest beta brainwaves at the bottom right region. A cycle per second in brainwave frequency is known as Hertz or HZ. From left to right and from top to bottom, it progresses from 1 to 4 cycles per second, delta, to 4 to 8 cycles per second, theta, to 8 to 13 cycles per second, alpha, to 13 to 30 plus cycles per second, low, mid-range, and high-range beta. The beta activity can be broken down into different frequency bands, such as 12 to 15 Hz, 15 to 18 Hz, 18 to 25 Hz, and 25 to 30 Hz. Therefore, the relative colors in each area show what's happening in each different brainwave state. For example, a lot of blue in a majority of the brain in 1 cycle per second of delta suggests that there's little activity of the brain in that delta range. And if there's a lot of red in 14 Hz alpha in the frontal lobe, it means that there's heightened alpha activity in that area of the brain. It should also be understood that these measurements could be interpreted differently depending on what the subject is doing when the scan is taken. For example, if 1 Hz delta were